Now, yesterday we began to look at a section that straddles the semester break, or the century break, rather. That is, we called L, I believe, Scotland in the 18th century. L, Scotland in the 18th century, and I'm going to go on in the next section after that to look at Scotland in the first half of the 19th century, which in which some very vital and stirring events occurred. The 18th century is largely preparation for and looking forward to those. I noticed from a couple of questions asked me at the end of the hour that I had not made clear the situation about the patronage map. And so we will go into that now and try to make it absolutely clear. As under number one under that, I called the general situation. And I believe it would be worth a couple of minutes just to review, to summarize what we've had about Scotland altogether. As you know, in pre-Reformation church history, those of you who had it, we have nothing about Scotland there. Scotland was an utterly pagan area, an area of wild tribes that the Romans, if they subdued one section, as soon as their troops went away, they were again on the rampage. And the Romans decided the only way they could handle the Scots was to put up a big wall at the northern end of England and keep them off. So during ancient church history, the Scots were just a group of wild savages north of the Roman wall. And then at the very end of Roman history, the end of the ancient world, St. Patrick, a man who may have been of Scots blood, he was from the north of England or from the south of Scotland, went to Ireland and had one of the greatest conversion efforts that the world has ever seen, and converted the Irish and began one of the greatest missionary movements the world has ever seen. And from Ireland, they came over and they, over the course of the next two or three centuries, converted the Scots to the Lord. And so Scotland became a nation which was nominally Christian, which had monasteries here and there, in which there were some people who were devoted to the Lord. There were a few scholars of real importance, a few missionaries of real importance in Scotland. But on the whole, the nation continued to be pretty much a nation of men feuding and fighting with one clan against another until the time of the Reformation. And then in the Reformation, you remember, the Scotch church was very backward and corrupt, and the ministers, the priests of it, were very little trained, most of them, and this made it easy for a few Scotchmen who studied with Luther and who became filled with zeal for justification by faith to go through the country, raising, leading people to the Lord and rousing enthusiasm, and very quickly Scotland became a Protestant nation. And it became a Protestant nation in which these few well-trained men had practically control of the religious life, and they trained others gradually, having these men partly trained, going about preaching and building up congregations and training elders, and Scotland, in a fairly brief time, became a nation which was thoroughly devoted to the Reformation teaching. And John Knox, the great leader of Scotland, had studied with Calvin, and Scotland became one of the great centers of Calvinist teaching. Then we notice how a Scotchman, the son of Mary Queen of Scots, became King of England. We saw that this semester, how James became King of England. And when he became King of England, tried to change the Scotch church, but failed. But he made some real steps in that direction. And his son Charles tried to suddenly change it, and the result was the outbreak of revolution in Scotland, which led to the revolution in England. And then we saw when Charles II came back, and in England, Puritanism was completely crushed, not by killing them off, but by making it impossible for them to preach, that in Scotland, this same thing could not well be done, because it's such a rough, wild, mountainous country that it would take us some money for it to hold it absolutely under control, while England, much more populous, much more settled, could be held under control more easily. So for 28 years in Scotland, from 1660 to 1688, The ardent Christians in Scotland were going off into the hills to have services. And when they had their services, every now and then the armies of the king would come upon them and would murder as many as they could get a hold of. And many individuals, ministers and noblemen, other leaders in Scotland, some hundreds of them, were hung publicly in Edinburgh because of their refusal to submit to the king's orders as to their religion. So you had this 28-year period, the period of the covenanter, when these people covenanted that they would never submit to attending a church in which the whole order of service was dictated by the King of England, and in which there were forms and ceremonies which reminded them of the Roman Catholic ceremonies, even though they were definitely Protestant in their main emphasis. And they during this period, thousands of them lost their lives, hundreds of them being publicly hung for their faith in Christ. And then in 1688, when King James was driven out of England, and William III came in, it naturally came about that the Scotch Church was free from what Charles II and James II had tried to enforce upon. And William III, the husband of Mary, the daughter of King James, and himself, the Stadtholder of Holland, they were interested in continental affairs, and their idea simply was that in Scotland, the church should be under their direction. Calvinistic teaching, which they favored, should be the central teaching, but they weren't much concerned with changes in church government and so on. So the people of Scotland made a strong request that they be permitted to revert to their former system of church government, in which the state was the protector of the church, but the control of the church was entirely in the hands of the people. The people in the churches electing their elders, the elders and the minister running the church, and the churches sending representatives to a presbytery which watched out to be sure there was sound doctrine and all the preaching in the presbytery, and then also sending representatives to synod meetings for a large part of the country, and representatives to a general assembly which had complete control of the church itself, which had been the system introduced by John Knox. Well, William rather reluctantly agreed to establish this again. There was a group of covenanters that refused to go along. They said the church is still too much under the royal authority. They said it should be stated in the constitution of the church that is not the king but the Lord Jesus Christ who is head of the church. And so this group called themselves covenanters, those the bulk of the covenanters had agreed to the new setup, but this group said they were also called Cameroonians after one of their prominent leaders. They said, until the church is freed from all state control and the state publicly acknowledges that Jesus Christ is head of the church and the state, we cannot attend the regular church. And they were a comparatively small number of them, but a very enthusiastic group, and they continue, I don't know whether any of them continue in Scotland to this day, but those of them who later came to the United States continued as a group known as the Covenanted Church in this country, also calling themselves the Reformed Presbyterian Church. And they have a college, Geneva College, in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, which in the last 30 years has quadrupled in size, and I think now probably not more than a fifth of the faculty and not more than a tenth of the students come from the covenanted group, but they still have the control of the church. They're a small group in this country. Most of them refuse to vote. They say they won't vote unless Jesus Christ is recognized in our constitution as the head of our nation. They will not vote at all or hold office. They are now a comparatively small group, but they do continue as a group in this country to this day. I don't know whether any remnants of them in Scotland or not. I had not mentioned them to you before. There have not been enough of them to be a big force in church history. But this was the first cliff from the Church of Scotland A larger split off than that was the group who during the 28 years had submitted to the king's orders, had attended the regular church services in which the services of the Church of England were conducted, and had become used to these services and liked them. And they continued as an Episcopal church in Scotland, which continues to this day. Not a large group, but a definite group in a number of sections of Scotland continuing this day, and we saw how the American Episcopal Church received its apostolic succession through that group. Well, the great bulk of the people in Scotland then were in the Church of Scotland, so-called, which was a church run by the people through the elders and the presbyteries, the synods, and the General Assembly. But I mentioned as number two last time, lay patronage reestablished. And this thing of lay patronage is something that is quite unfamiliar to us, we being entirely accustomed to the idea of a free church, a church which is entirely separate from the state, something that is a comparatively recent thing. Because in most countries, up until within the last century or two, in most countries, the country was understood to belong to a certain church, and the church was the official church of the country. They might tolerate other churches, but one church was the established church. In Holland to this day, the king, or queen as it has been for the last three generations, is required by law to be a member of the Reformed Church of Holland, which includes a larger number of the people of Holland, though there are a number of other churches in Holland. The prime minister often is a Roman Catholic in Holland. They belong to different denominations. But the king, by law, is thus required. And in England, the royal family is supposed to belong to the Church of England, and the king is officially the head of the Church of England. This was universal until within the last century or two. The difference was that in Scotland, the church, while being established by the nation, protected by the nation, theoretically the property belonging to the state, its control was supposed to rest in the hands of the representatives of the churches and the ministers of the church. So that was the situation which had been before the attempt to bring the Church of Scotland under complete control of the state, which led to the 28 years of killing time, as they call it. Now in 1688, they wanted that reestablished, and King William, rather grudgingly, agreed to what they thought was a complete reestablishment of it. But when King William and his wife died, the next ruler was his wife's sister Anne. And Anne was devoted to the Church of England. And she was quite generally Tory in her sympathies. And the Tories, the High Church Party, which had been in control under Charles II, came into power again in England. But Anne did not live long enough. She was already a widow, long in years when she became queen. She did not live long enough to give them a chance to make any great changes in England. And anyway, in England at that time, as you remember, the whole situation was one of general dullness and deadness in the church, with very little spiritual life of any kind, but with the regular carrying on of the services, which preserved those wonderful words of Cranmer, which had the gospel expressed in them if a person would listen closely and see what was said. Well, the Tories under Ash wanted to do away with the toleration of people who were not in the Church of England. But the time was too short for them to move very far in that direction before she died, and that period came to an end. But in Scotland, by this time, Scotland was a part of Britain. We have noticed how King James became King of England, but when he did, England and Scotland were still separate nations. They were separate nations with the same king, so in control, it largely came from the king. But as far as Parliament is concerned, each country had its own Parliament, all through the 17th century. But in the 18th century, in 1707, an act of union was passed, which united Scotland and England into one nation. They're not completely one nation. I was talking with a woman in England whose husband was a Scotchman, and she said how her family in London felt so bad she'd married a foreigner. That was just a couple of years ago. There's that feeling that, and I was speaking to an English woman in the train in Scotland, and she being in the train, I thought she was Scotch, and when I said something, she showed it, oh, she was shocked. Did anybody take her for Scotch? There's a very strong feeling of distinct nation. Yes, between Scotland and England, and it's a great deal of difference in the law between the two nations. But they are controlled by one parliament. They're one nation, and they are equally loyal to the king and the general government of Britain. They're both very strong British, but they have a very strong, distinct feeling in the two. They are two nations this day. But in 1707, the Act of Union was passed, which made them one nation, in the sense that one parliament in London had representatives from both areas. And in 17, or some books say 1107, some books say 1712. So my guess is that the law was passed in 11 and the Queen in December, and the Queen signed it in January 12th, but I don't know. But it's at least one of those 2 years when the law was passed, re-establishing patronage, lay patronage, throughout Scotland. Now, this lay patronage was something which had come down from the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, it was customary when a duke or a prince or a leader of any kind, when his oldest son became the heir to his territory and the great civil ruler, to train his second son to be in the church, and he was to become a leader in the church. Remember, Henry VIII was second son and was trained to be in the church, and then when his older brother died, he became king of England. But he had better education than any king up to that time, because he had been trained originally for the church. And this was customary, to look out for a good place for the second son in the church. And so when the time of the Reformation, the landholders, and that's another thing in Britain that's different from America, most of the land in Britain, England, and Scotland is owned by a comparatively few people who own tremendous large tracts of land and are paid rent regularly by everyone who lives on that land. Comparatively few people own all the land. Well, the landholders in Scotland wanted to continue to have considerable control over the church, and the church resisted. And this was done away with in the time of Cromwell, completely done away with. And in the re-establishment after the 28 years killing time, it had not been re-established, but some of these men had close connection with similar men in England, and the Parliament under Queen Anne voted that the lay patronage was re-established. That is to say, the landholder, whose taxes paid the greater part of the support of the church, had the right to present a man as minister of the church. Now, in England, in many places, I think to this day, he has the right to say who is going to be the minister in the established church. He, of course, the higher authorities could interfere, but he has a great power there. I know in many very modern sections of England, there are individual landholders who are strong Christians who keep their church in their area in the hands of strong evangelicals. But in Scotland, now, it was made that the patron, the landholder, the man of power and influence in the area, he presents the minister. However, they said, though he presents the minister, of course he can't become the minister unless the congregation calls him, and unless the presbytery examines him and approves of his doctrine. And so, at first, this didn't cause any great trouble. For a few years, the landholders got the habit of looking about for a good man to succeed the one who had just been minister, had retired or died or moved to another place, and they would present a man, and if the congregation didn't call him, they'd present another one. But pretty soon, a few unscrupulous landholders began seeing how they could save money by presenting somebody the church didn't like at all. And then when they turned him down, spending a few years hunting for another man, in the meantime keeping the money that would go to the upkeep of the church. And a few unscrupulous men did that, yes?
I thought that tax was paid for the upkeep of the
church. Yeah, the tax was came from the example.
Oh, okay. The tax were owing to the church, yeah. Okay. Well, I thought the tax were going forward.
No, they were largely from local. So that the... this, a few men doing this, increased the power of the local, the patron, to some extent. And I mentioned yesterday, number three, the Secession Church, 1733. See, this is about 20 years after patronage was reestablished. But there was this minister, Ebenezer Erskine. Ebenezer Erskine, who was a great Christian preacher, a very able evangelist, a man who had a very wide influence. And he said, why should the lay people determine, yes? Yeah, Ebenezer, E-B-E-N-E-Z-E-R, Ebenezer, E-B-E-N-E-Z-E-R, Erskine, E-R-S-K-I-N-E, E-R-S-K-I-N-E. Ebenezer Erskine's sermon, I mentioned to you how Dr. Maris told me that in Holland, a century after that time, those sermons in Dutch translation were having a great influence in Holland. He was evidently a very great preacher and a very great Christian man, and he preached against this business of the layman appointing the minister. He preached strongly against it, and two or three other ministers joined with him. The synod reprimanded them for it, and they were censured by the synod, but the synod said, if they will confess the error, we will remove the censure. But they refused to confess it. So they were dropped from the church for that, and this did not make any great stir throughout the church. It was a comparatively small group, but it began a new church, which its enemies called it the Secession Church, and gradually the people came to accept the term the enemies gave them. And so it became known as the Secession Church. It started in 1732. It was a small group, but others gradually came to them. It never became a great large group, but it became a fairly sizable little denomination. It had 45 different churches at the little time. And then they ran into a new difficulty because there was a law enacted that everyone who held any position in the town, and a man, a citizen of a town, was called a burgher. A burgher was a citizen of the town. And people today often use the French bourgeois, but they used the Dutch one was burgher. And there was a law enacted that in order to vote in civil affairs, in order to do most anything in civil affairs, one was required to take an oath that he approved of the true church of Christ as presently existing in thought. And being required to take this oath, some of the Secession Church split in two. Some of them said, we cannot take an oath like this, we have left the established. We cannot take an oath that we approve of the true church of Christ as it stands in Scotland today. We cannot do it. So they called them the anti-burghers. While others said, yes, we can take the oath because the true church of Christ is our church. And it is here in Scotland today, and so we approve of the church of Christ as established today. It means we approve of our church. And so they interpreted the two ways. And the anti-burghers felt that this was a Christian word, that actually they were agreeing to the evil system of patronage in taking the oath, and they could not cooperate with burghers at all. And a funny thing happened after this. Some of the members of the burgher church migrated to America, and they established some little churches here and there in this country. And they, it was a small group here, never became one of the largest groups, but These were the anti-burger portion of the Confession Church. Then there was a much smaller group of the burger church that migrated to this country. And they were in America, and they were all alone here. They had, they said, well, now here are these other members of the Confession Church. They are the anti-burger people. Their doctrines are exactly like ours. Let's cooperate with them. So they did. And when the people in Scotland heard about it, they said, my, you cannot cooperate with those people. That is impossible. And they sent orders to them. You lose all contact with us if you cooperate with them. So in America, there was no burger oath. And what does being burger or anti-burger mean in America? But they were forced in America here to be two separate denominations on account of the difference in Scotland. Well, fortunately, this didn't last long, because after a few years in Scotland, the burghers and the anti-burghers got together again. And so you had this Secession Church, a small group, which I wouldn't take much time on now if it were not for the fact that it is background to a later development. Yes? Well, of course, church changed over the 30 years. I'm not sure just what group it is today that claims to be the descendant of this. I'm not sure it is. But number four is the Relief Church. The Relief Church. In 1752, there was a fine Scotch minister named Thomas Gillespie who became dissatisfied with the system of patronage. And Thomas Gillespie left the Church of Scotland, and he continued by himself for a time, simply as an independent minister, preaching the same Calvinistic doctrine as the other churches did, but without any association with them. And after a few years, he was joined by Thomas Boston, another fine preacher, and they organized a presbytery together. And they called their presbytery the Relief Presbytery, because they wanted to give relief to churches that were oppressed by lay patrons. And so the Relief Church was another church, a small group, and yet a group that soon had branches in different parts of Scotland, that came out of the Secession Church. No, it came out of the main church of Scotland, but it was parallel with the Secession Church, but separate from it. Yes? Well, that's his father. That's the father of the man I was speaking of. Yes. Yes, his father was a very great theological writer who wrote the Fourfold State. But this is his son. Yes. Well, now, the situation then, at the end of the 18th century, is that you have in the Church of Scotland, you have good many very true, loyal Christian preachers. You have a number of men who boast of the fact that they are modern. That is, they claim they hold the same doctrines as the others, but they don't believe in enthusiasm. They want to stress culture and a good style of preaching, and they are modern. They believe in these doctrines, but they don't like enthusiasm. And toward the end of the century, the moderates were coming to be in the majority in the church, so there were many who were definitely not moderate. And here, the turn of the century comes, we'll move on to Roman numeral 8. Roman numeral 8, but we make no real break here, because Roman numeral 8 is the 19th century, and we will call capital A under Roman numeral 8, Scotland in the first half of the 19th century. Scotland in the first half of the 19th century. And now we notice, number one, the persisting problem of patronage. The persisting problem of patronage. It is about as it has been before, but it is affected by a change which is coming into the Church of Scotland. We'll call that number two, the increase of evangelical fervor. At about the turn of the century, there began a great increase in evangelical fervor within the Church of Scotland, an increase which in the course of the next 30 years became so great that the moderates were left in a very small number in the church, though they had been probably the majority at the beginning of the century. Now, in this, there are certain names that stand out. Under this heading, number two, I'm going to mention three men. One of them, Robert Murray McCheyne. Robert Murray McCheyne died when he was only 30 years of age. But during that brief time, he made a real impact in Scotland. He was a man of burning zeal for Christ and for winning souls for Christ. He was a very strong premillennialist, and he was a very strong premillennialist, and a man with a great interest in spreading the gospel abroad. He made a trip to Palestine in order to study the possibility of establishing a mission for the Jews in Palestine for the Church of Scotland. I attended the Bible Institute of Los Angeles for 1 year before I went to seminary, and I remember Dr. R.A. Torrey there saying that he believed every minister ought to read every year, for its effect on his spiritual life, the book of Memoir and Remains of Robert Murray McCheyne, which was written after his death by one of his close friends. And this book shows you the burning heart of this man who was so zealous for Christ and so zealous to spread the knowledge of the gospel. He was the pastor of the church in Dundee, in Scotland. But he died, unfortunately, at the age of 30. But he had a real influence at that time, and so did his two close friends, Andrew Bonar and Horatius Bonar. Andrew Bonar wrote a book, God's Way of Holiness, which I remember a few years ago, I think somebody gave copies to every student of the seminary a few years ago. I haven't seen it lately, but in paper cover it has been distributed in recent years. It's one of the finest books on true holiness, I think, that ever was written. Andrew Bonar, B-O-N-A-R, very close friend of McCheyne. It is he who published the Memoirs and Remains of Robert Murray McCheyne. And Andrew Bonar's brother, Horatius Bonar, was also a great Christian leader. He wrote the hymns, I Heard the Voice of Jesus Say, Come Unto Me and Rest. He wrote a number of hymns that are found in many of our hymn books today. These were a group of very earnest Christians whose influence spread more and more to Scotland. And then one of this group, by virtue of his very great personal ability, is so important in what happened, though no greater Christian than these three we just mentioned, but perhaps a more able man than they were, that we give him a separate head. Number three, Thomas Chalmers. Thomas Chalmers, C-H-A-L-M-E-R-S. Thomas Chalmers had been ordained to the ministry in 1803. And at first, someone called him a typical modern. That is, he knew the theology, and he preached true theology, but he was more interested in mathematics than in theology. And he taught mathematics in the university. He was a very able teacher of mathematics, and his interests were more general than specifically on the ministry. And then, after 7 years of a lifeless ministry, he had a great experience of the renewing and transforming power of the gospel. And the parishioners quickly noted the change that took place in their young minister. One of them said he would bend over the pulpit and press us to take the gift as if he held it that moment in his hand and would not be satisfied till every one of us had got possession of it. And often when the sermon was over and the psalm was sung and he rose to pronounce the blessing, he would break out afresh with some new increase. unwilling to let us go until he had made one more effort to persuade us to accept of it. He was filled with zeal to reach people with the knowledge of the Lord. He was a very, very able speaker and an extremely learned man. When he would go to England, great crowds would come to hear him in London, and the university leaders and the leaders in the nobility in England were always thrilled to meet him and to talk with him. So great was the ability of Thomas Chalmers. And Chalmers went to a larger church. From there, he went to Glasgow, took a tremendous interest in the preaching in Glasgow, and he found a very poor section of the town, Glasgow, where the city was spending $100,000 in relief for the paupers of this area in order to enable them to have a bare subsistence where there was a tremendous amount of drunkenness and crime. And he aroused the interest of his congregation in trying to reach these people with the gospel and to help them. And in the course of a few years, they made such a change there that the amount of relief that was given by the city to these people could be cut to one-fifth of what it had been before. And the people were industriously working and were enthusiastically attending churches where the gospel was being preached. And he is, in secular history, he is looked upon as one who did a great work in social benefit and social change, though they may be apt then to overlook how great a part in it, along with his skillful thinking and clever planning, the central position of the gospel occupied. But Chalmers was very active in the ministry, and then he went to Edinburgh to become professor of theology in Edinburgh University. Many people felt very badly that he left the active pastorate. He never abandoned preaching, but Dr. Collins says it cannot be doubted that in deciding as he did, he was divinely guided, for as professor he was in intimate touch with the rising ministry of the church, who in due course carried his teaching throughout the length and breadth of the land. And so these developments went on this way until 1833, when, under the leadership of Chalmers, the majority of the people in the Church of Scotland decided to take a strong stand against this evil of patronage. They decided that they would act as an assembly to declare that it was the right of the presbytery to refuse to install a man who was presented by a lay patron if he was an unworthy man, and that the church should have the right to select its own minister rather than to have the lay man do the selecting. As Chalmers said, the patron may be a complete unbeliever. He may be one who has no interest in the church. He said there's no reason why he should be the man who determines who is going to be the minister of the church. And this brought them into collision with the state immediately, because the state declared that the church must accept the man who was appointed, but who was presented by the patron. In October in 1834, the Earl of Kinnoull presented a man named Robert Young to be pastor of a church in Perthshire. Only two parishioners voted that were willing to sign the call to this man. 287 male heads of family who were communicative members of the congregation signified their disapproval of the nominee, and the presbytery accordingly declined to take him on trial for ordination. But the Earl of Kinnoull appealed to the secular court, which declared that the General Assembly had no right to pass an act that they would not take on a minister whom the patron wanted to have, and the court upheld him and ordered the presbytery to examine the man and to install him, and if they were not, did not do so, to pay a fine of $50,000. And similar cases began to occur in other parts of the country. The church was now taking a definite stand against it, and they were coming into sharp collision with the civil court. Thomas Guthrie of Edinburgh was a visiting minister who went to a place where the people wanted a certain minister, and the patron wanted an unworthy man installed that no one in the church wanted. And the court served a notice that the visiting minister should not preach there. And Guthrie said, in going to preach at Strathbogie, I was met by an interdict from the court of session, an interdict to which, as regards civil matters, I gave implicit obedience. On the Lord's Day, when I was preparing for divine service, in came a servant of the law and handed me an interdict. I told him he'd done his duty and I would do mine. The interdict forbade me, under penalty of the Calton Hall jail, to preach the gospel in the parish churches of Strathbogie. I said, the parish churches are stone and lime and belong to the state. I will not intrude there. It forbade me to preach the gospel in the schoolhouse. I said, the schoolhouses are stone and lime and belong to the state. I will not intrude there. It forbade me to preach in the churchyard. And I said, the dust of the dead is the state, and I will not intrude there. But when these lords of session forbade me to preach my master's blessed gospel and offer salvation to sinners anywhere in that district under the arch of heaven, I put the interdict under my feet, and I preached the gospel. And this is the attitude which was characteristic of these men during this 10 years of struggle after the General Assembly passed the act in 1834. During the next 10 years, they were struggling against the civil authorities in their opposition to the power of the patrons to put in the ministers and their assistants. The church had selected its own ministers. And the matter finally came before the Houses of Parliament in London, and there the Parliament upheld the established law that they must install as minister the man whom the patrons selected. And the result was that at the General Assembly in 1843, at the General Assembly, they met and they heard the order given to them from the Parliament. And then Thomas Chalmers declared that he could not submit to the order. Rather than do so, it would be necessary for him to leave the church. And 500 ministers, led by Chalmers, marched out from the assembly meeting and formed a free church. And the amount of income that they gave up amounted to hundreds of thousands of dollars that they gave up in doing this. Many of the families of them starved because there was no means of sustenance. They had a very difficult time during the next few years. The lairds refused to allow them to hold services on their land. They would go out into the hills, and sometimes in the snow and in the cold, they'd have 2,000 or 3,000 people standing while they preached to them. In one place where the lairds refused to rent them any place where they could build a church or hold a church, they had a big boat made. There was a lake there, and they had a big boat made and towed up there from Glasgow, and they brought it in and put it on the lake, and on this lake they held their church. And so the Free Church, under Chalmers' leadership, and with the Bonars working strongly beside him, McShane had died just before this occasion started. The Free Church, which started in with nothing, soon became the great leading church in Scotland. But it took hard work over a long period of years, and the zeal of the people was tremendous as they stood out in the cold and in the rain, listening to services in the open air during those years before they were able to get money to build new churches and get permission for places to build. Well, we continue that tomorrow.